You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time to check in with Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com, for a look at the week in politics. And Jim, good to talk with you again.
Always my pleasure. We had quite a last few days.
Yes, we did indeed. Super Tuesday not being so super for Nikki Haley, but being super for Donald Trump.
They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one.
And it was a big one. At the time, Nikki Haley hadn't dropped out yet. Your reaction to some of the Tuesday results, and we have to, of course, some of the things we talk about, we have to always remember, it ain't over till weeks later.
Yes, correct. I mean, most of them, the California votes actually were a little bit more clear this time than they have been in the past few elections. So it isn't going to be waiting for weeks on most of these races. But, the one I paid most attention to, of course, was the U.S. Senate race and Steve Garvey doing so well and Katie Porter doing so poorly.
Yeah. Part of that thanks to the notoriety of someone who's played baseball for years in two major markets of the state, well-known. And then also, you got to thank Adam Schiff, who we were talking about this last week, in which he tactically figured out, I'd rather like to run against one person than the other. Explain what happened.
Oh, no question about it. And it's an after effect of the jungle primary system where everybody's on the same ballot and then the top two people advance. And in a situation like California, where it's really a one-party state, Schiff saw, and other people have done this, but he did it very well, that I want to run against the Republican, Steve Garvey, and not another Democrat who could raise a fortune like Katie Porter. So he started running these ads that you may have all seen that talked about Steve Garvey being too conservative for California. Well, where he was running those ads were in the most Republican areas of the state in order to try to unite the Republicans around Garvey, because knowing just the mathematics, the Republicans obviously being a big minority in the state, but together they could push a candidate into the finals in a big crowded field like the U.S. Senate race. And that's exactly what happened.
Let's go back to the presidential one. What do you do with Nikki Haley's folks that she had? What are the possibilities with the Nikki Haley camp going over to Trump?
Oh, definitely. There needs to be a reconciliation period here. Trump needs those people to come his way. The general election is going to be very, very close again, and he cannot afford to, lose, about 20-25% of the Republican vote, which was going to her. So he needs to get the absolute lion's share of those. So I think you'll see some reconciliation period with Trump definitely trying to make a play to unite the entire Republican Party, which he needs to do. And we'll see, what Nikki Haley does and if she is conciliatory towards him or not, which she needs to be, I think, for her future. I think her best move, endorse Trump and just really kind of stay quiet for the rest of the time.
Over to the Gascon Hockman for the LA DA's race, which has garnered national attention because of the progressive policies, lack of really cracking down and prosecuting folks here that Gascon is known for.
So he's forced into a secondary election in the general, correct?
Yes. 22% of the vote went to Gascon. Hockman with 18%. Deputy DA Jonathan Natami with 12%. But, those numbers will fluctuate. So.
Well, but that does mean that 78% of the people did not vote for Gascon.
Yes.
And that's not a good sign for him.
Right. Talk about that. You always look at the people who are split and then reuniting. So let's say, go back to the Steve Garvey Schiff race. And some people say, whoa, maybe Steve Garvey could do a win. And the people like you say, well, if you go and add up all the other people, if you take Katie Porter and Barbara Lee, then that's how Schiff wins, right? Because it's just the sheer number of Democrats, they're not going to go to Garvey.
And that was his calculation, Schiff's, and basically advertising to help pull Garvey over the line and get him in the general election. Kind of like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I mean, in the presidential race nationally, he has the one thing that an independent would need, and that is that everybody knows his name. And that's incredibly important. So Garvey certainly gives the Republicans a credible candidate in this Senate race, something they've not had in a very long time.
measure HLA on track to pass. This is one of those things that comes along where people say, okay, we need to have hundreds of bus and bicycle lanes put on our streets. And of course, opponents of that say, wait a second, you don't just get to add a lane to add those kind of lanes. You have to take away a driving lane for cars. Indeed, that's the case. And so critics say it's going to make traffic more of a nightmare out here for this green cause of having all these, bicycle lanes. I see those bike lanes out here where they do that. They're empty, and the traffic in the car lane has to back up. That's just a kind of a battle that's going on now, isn't it?
And that's part of the reason they do it, because they try to force people out of the cars. It's much harder in the West when there isn't as much like a subway system. But where I am in the Washington, D.C. area, yes, that's part of the strategy, because they want to make driving so miserable that they'll force people onto the metro that, frankly, doesn't work very well.
The rule has been you ride the bus until you can afford a car, and then you never go back. It's kind of been the mantra here. And maybe it's not politically correct, but, you know, maybe you kind of do like being in your own car sometimes.
Of course. Yeah, of course. There's no doubt about it. And it's the most efficient way to get anywhere.
What else is going on?
To get back on the Democratic side, we've got Biden will be the presumptive nominee for them on March 19th. Now, what that means is that he will have enough first ballot votes that are bound by state law or party rule to win the Democratic nomination. Now, Trump obviously will have that too, but now it's moot with Haley out of the race. But this talk of trying to replace Biden after March 19th, I think it really becomes impossible to do that, because the only way that he won't be nominated is if he himself decides to get out of the race, and that's just not going to happen.
There is some talk of Michelle Obama, but her camp has come out saying that she is not going to run. And then, of course, some pundit on Fox News and goes, says, parse words. She doesn't want to run, but if she were appointed at the convention, she might take it. Aha. You know, kind of that going on. You don't see that happening.
It's ridiculous. That's just not going to happen, because, again, Biden, by March 19th, will have enough delegates to be the nominee. And those votes are locked in by state law. Once again, somebody on Fox News doesn't pay attention to what the rules are. But this talk of her coming in, I mean, I don't know how many times she has to say no. I believe her that she wouldn't do it. And even if she does at this point, it's almost impossible for that to happen without Biden's concurrence. Yeah. And he's not going to concur. The last thing the Democratic leadership wants would be an open convention where the delegates would be free to vote for however or whoever they want. And they don't want that. So Biden would really have to stay on the ballot or as the nominee until the end of the Democratic National Convention, which would be August 22nd. And at that point, if he were to step aside, then the Democratic National Committee, the 400 members, could decide who the nominee is. But they're really going to do that, right? At that point in time, change horses as we get that close to the general election. It's just absurd to really be talking about that.
Okay. We will cease talking about it. Republican Ken Calvert narrowly leading Democrat Will Rawlins in the race for the 41st congressional district. Now, that's being viewed as one of the key congressional races, with some believing it will determine if Republicans or Democrats have control of Congress. Calvert, the incumbent, leading with about 47% of the vote, Rawlins with 44% of the vote. But I imagine there'll be a lot of money spent out there.
Well, no doubt about it. I mean, it's one of many that would decide the outcome of the House. Yeah, that's an important race. Ken Calvert's been in office for close to 30 years, if not that, and the district isn't as good for him. I mean, after the redistricting, he won last time with about 52% of the vote against the same opponent, and so they hope this time they can take him out. And, yeah, it's definitely a race to pay attention to. It is one of the key races. I'm not sure it's the definitive one, but it's one of the key races around the country that will help determine if Republicans or Democrats are the majority in the U.S. House.
Let's see. State Representative Vince Fong leading the race to fill the congressional seat formerly held by Kevin McCarthy. McCarthy resigned from Congress at the end of last year after being ousted as Speaker of the House. Fong, a Republican, had 38% of the vote Educator Marissa Wood, a Democrat, trailing him with 24% to Larry County Sheriff Max Boudreau, a Republican, in third place with 23% of the vote. The congressional district, parts of which are in Kern, Tulare, Kings, and Fresno County. That's, again, one of those ones where, you know, when you add up the Republican vote, the Republican will win in November.
Well, and it's possible we'll see two Republicans advance. That one's been going back and forth on second place. And don't forget, all that whole group is on the ballot again on March 19th for the special election to fill the balance of the current term. So what we saw on Super Tuesday was the regular election in November for the term beginning in 2025. But on March 19th, and it's almost the same group that will be on the ballot. Some of them didn't run in the special. They'll run there. If somebody gets 50%, then they'll immediately take the seat. If not, then it goes to a runoff election in May, I believe. And then the winner at that point becomes the member immediately.
Republican Scott Baugh leading in the race for the Orange County U.S. House seat being vacated by Katie Porter. Porter, a Democrat, as we talked about earlier, gave up the 47th district seat for what now is an unsuccessful run for U.S. Senate. Baugh, who narrowly lost to Porter in 2022, had 33% of vote, leading Democrat State Senator Dave Mann, who has been dubbed by him DUI Dave, by the way, who has 25% of the vote. 10 candidates vying for the district, which, of course, represents parts of Irvine, Costa Mesa, Huntington Beach, Newport Beach, and Seal Beach. Your thought about Scott Baugh?
This is a very critical race, too, and has major national implications because this is a race that the Republicans, if Baugh can win this, will take from the Democrats, and that is as important for the Republicans as maybe defeating Ken Calvert in Riverside is for the Democrats. So these are real critical races to watch, not only in California, but nationally.
Jim Ellis, EllisInsight.com, thank you for your wise counsel. Good to talk with you again, and we'll check in with you next week.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Steve Frank is publisher of California Political News and Views, and he joins us to share a few with us post-election this week. And, well, technically not post-election because, as you and I both know, these things drag on for weeks, don't they?
Well, in the state of California, it does. But for those who stayed up late Tuesday night, 14 other states easily finished their ballot counting. They had no problem. When Michigan had their votes, they had no problem. New Hampshire, South Carolina, no problems. Iowa, no problems. Yeah. But here in California, it takes us literally 37 days to count the ballot.
Yeah.
And I went to the Secretary of State's website, and they noted Wednesday morning that in 37 days they'll have the final account.
There you go. There you go. And I was looking at the L.A. Times or the Los Angeles Times, and I have a piece in there talking about how, you know, the long election, no, that's how it's designed. That's a benefit. Kind of interesting how, you know, sometimes you look at articles in that thing to figure out how not to think. Okay, some quick reactions to the election as of now, as of the results, unofficial. Go ahead.
Well, there are two really big points, and they kind of connect. First is Proposition 1. Proposition 1 is extremely close. It's going back and forth between the yeses and the noes being in charge. But the more important point is the yes people spent over $6 million to get a yes vote. The no people had no organized campaign, and the opponents spent less than $50,000. So the California public made a determination that these bonds are bad. But going to the second point as to how come it was that close is because on the Democrat side, the Democrats, as I go through all the Assembly, State, Senate, and Congressional districts, I note that the vote totals for Democrats are down dramatically, district by district. There are Republicans that are extremely close to the Democrats for the runoff in November, and that shouldn't be in those districts. And that's because the Democrats, for some reason, couldn't come out to vote. They made a determination that Biden was going to win the nomination out of California. That was a foregone conclusion. And the fight between Schiff and Porter was, as I like to say, a battle between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. And most people didn't care which side won. And so the vote total, which certainly helped Garvey in getting his vote total up so high, was because the Democrats didn't come out to vote.
Yeah. How about all the money that was spent because of the jungle primary? You get Schiff deciding that, oh, okay, I'll put out ads to talk about Steve Garvey and say he's too MAGA for California. He likes this or that. You know, look, they play the game, don't they? You strategize and figure out how do you get where you want to be. Schiff wants to run against Garvey because he knows that if he adds Porter's votes to the ones he got and a little bit that went to Barbara Lee, he wins, right?
Well, but you also have to mention that he spent, Schiff spent $6 million on ads promoting Steve Garvey, while Katie Porter spent over $1 million with ads promoting Eric Early as the real Trump candidate. And that was on radio and TV across the state, both of them.
How did we get the jungle primary? Who thought that was such a great idea?
It was the person who wanted to destroy the Republican Party, a guy named Arnold Schwarzenegger. Arnold did not believe in political parties. He certainly did not believe in the Republican Party. He denounced it every chance he got, even though he took its label to run for governor and then became a Democrat governor within months of him being elected. The sad part is the Republican Party played along with it at the time when those of us said this will destroy the Republican Party. But more important than the Republican Party, it's destroyed politics in California. It allowed the game playing that Schiff and Porter played during the election using Trump people against themselves to help the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. And the whole system is wrong.
Can you fix it, or is it impossible to go back, or would the Democrats love it?
The Democrats love it in most cases, but when you see a race like they're going to have in San Jose for Congress, the top two are two Democrats, and they're going to spend a lot of money against each other, money that they would prefer to use against Republicans. And remember, you now have a situation where Adam Schiff is going to be able to spend tens of millions of dollars against Republican candidates because Garvey is now the nominee of the Republican of the state. And so the Democrats do have instances where they don't like it, and there are seven or eight Democrat versus Democrat races in the state. And there's one major Republican versus Republican race. That's in the old McCarthy district, Boudreaux versus Fong.
Yeah. So what is this initiative that is putting L.A. on a road diet that voters apparently want here? Because I don't get it. I can get, you know, adding bike lanes and bus lanes, but the road is only so wide. And the only way to do that is to take away a driving lane, which then makes traffic, which is already horrible in Los Angeles, even worse, right?
Well, and remember that not only are they going to put in a bike lane, they're going to try to put in a special lane just for buses that cars aren't going to be allowed in. And you're right. And if you want to see what happens when you put your city on a
road diet. Yeah.
Go to San Francisco. The main street in San Francisco is Market Street, one of the most famous streets in the world. No cars are allowed. And there are dozens of other streets where cars have been banned as well. Then what they've done for more streets is instead of having a four-way stop and you go through the stop, They put up a roadblock in the middle of it that you have to go around. They create a roundabout. You see some of those in Long Beach, roundabouts. But San Francisco is now putting in roundabouts to slow traffic. And, of course, the slower the traffic, the more people get angry that they can't get to where they want to go to. And if you can't go on Market Street, which is the main street in town, you have to park your car far, far away. And the price of parking your car for 2 hours, about three blocks from Market Street, $45 to $50 for the first 2 hours.
Nice. Now, that's as long as you own the parking rights there, boy, you could really make a mint. So they want to do to L.A. What they've done to San Francisco. All they need to do is import the needles and something else, right?
That's correct. And they started this road diet business years ago. I only go to downtown Los Angeles when my client pays me hazardous duty pay. It's too dangerous for me to go down there. When I do go down there, I notice how they've made most of the streets in downtown L.A. one-way streets, which also causes confusion, causes people to go further than they want to just to get to where they want to go. And, of course, when you look at the parking situation, there it's $15 easy, and it's $30 to $40 to park in downtown L.A., but there's a reason for that, because in the city of Los Angeles, city takes a 10% tax on your parking fee. So the city gets 10% of that.
There you go. Quickly, let's go through some of the races here. Republican Ken Calvert, narrowly leading Democrat Will Rollins in the race for California's 41st Congressional District. This is supposed to be one of the key races to watch. The Dems would love to flip this, and they say if they flip it, maybe they can flip Congress in the fall. Is the Calvert one the one to worry about?
Calvert is just one of the ones. There's others to worry about. But the problem, and that goes again to what I said earlier about the Democrat votes not coming out. Rollins did not get the normal votes he should have gotten as a Democrat in that race. And so the closeness makes it even worse because we know the Democrats didn't come out to vote. And you can imagine that come November, there's going to be a series of ballot measures that the Democrats want passed. Schiff is going to use this, as will Biden, to show why the Democrats have to come out. The world will collapse if you don't elect them. And so you got to vote. And so they will push the vote November. One of the big points you could make is that on the college campuses throughout the state, there was no push to vote. Just the normal, put up some signs, don't forget to vote and all that. But come November, they're going to bring out the college vote. And you're going to see a much bigger Democrat vote than you did on March 5th.
Okay. To Republican Scott Baugh, leading the race for the Orange County U.S. House seat being vacated by Katie Porter. The one thing that Republicans can point to is, okay, at least they got Porter out of that office because she ran and lost for the Senate seat.
Well, one of the more interesting things, if you add up the Republican votes versus Democrat votes, the Republicans got a little more votes than the Democrats. But again, we don't know how big the Democrat turnout will be in November. But here's a kicker, a prediction that I could make 99.9% sure. I believe Scott Baugh is going to win this seat. And his opponent in 2026 is going to be a lady by the name of Katie Porter.
That's how it works.
She's already told people she's planning to run.
Yeah, and she's supposed to be a pretty good fundraiser.
She is a good fundraiser. She raised, I believe, around $20 million for this race.
All right. Steve Frank, where can people read you?
They can read me at California Political News and Views, capoliticalnewsandviews.com, capoliticalnewsandviews.com.
One of those will work.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Have a great day.
Stay tuned for the second half of our program. More coming up.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
My next guest is Maxim Lott. He is joining us to tell us about a website that he has put up that essentially kind of compares the leanings, the biases of these chat systems, these AIs that are out there now. And it's a fascinating subject. Maxim, it's good to have you on our program today. Nice to meet you.
Hey, great to be here with you.
I have to admit that I find myself engaging in, you know, conversations with these computer AIs, trying to see if I can, you know, trip them up or where they stand on things. And I'll say something like, you know, is it okay if you break into a bank to keep the money? And then it'll say, of course not. You know, there are laws. Then I'll say, is it okay to break into a country, cross the border, and get to stay? And it will say, well, that depends. And it lists all these things out. And it won't be definitive that, no, it's wrong. And you sit there and you get frustrated. I have a sense that you also started playing with these systems too, didn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how many of the listeners have tried these AI systems yet, but these are really, I think, like the next internet. They're still primitive at this point, but you can already see the potential. And, you can ask some of these things like, draw me a painting of George Washington, and they'll do a pretty good job. It'll, you know, something that a couple of years ago you would have had to pay someone a $500 commission to do. Now it just does it for you, and it's okay. I use it for my blog posts. It makes these nice cover art images for them. Now this AI bias, which you were talking about, how it's kind of wishy-washy, won't give you an answer to a lot of political questions. That really hit the news like a week ago because Google released this new AI, Google Gemini Advanced, and people would ask it for things like, draw me a picture of George Washington. And it makes him, he's wearing the old clothes, but it makes him Native American or Black or Hispanic every time. And this is because the Google programmers put in basically every question you ask, it would just add in parentheses for the AI secretly and make it diverse. And so they got a lot of blowback from this. They're now redesigning their system. But this was kind of the most overt bias that anyone had seen in AI. My website, trackingai.org, it tries to pick up on these more subtle things. And it gives a 60-question political quiz to them. And also all sorts of things. Like most AIs think that you should not be able to buy and sell land. And by the way, we've added some words that get the AIs to answer almost every question. Like, you know, please answer specifically. Do you strongly disagree, slightly agree? And we've gotten them to answer almost all these. So it's interesting. A lot of them also endorse a Marxist quote that is from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Most of them agree with that, and that's a little bit crazy.
Yeah. So is it come to these people on the left own these companies, or does it come to the fact that the guy, the 23-year-old or 28-year-old who's programming it, is kind of a leftist and feels a little pressure to make it, you know, really fair with quotes around it? I mean, do we know behind the scenes what's going on and how we're getting these?
We do have some sense. So basically, these AIs are trained on almost the whole internet. And there might be a little bit of bias in there because, you know, Wikipedia leans left, a lot of the media leans left. But then what the AI companies do is they do human reinforcement learning, where they often outsource this to foreign workers, and they just give them a list of instructions and say, you know, this is what a good answer is. This is what a bad one is. And they often put some bias in those directions where something said against Muslims could be rated much higher, more sensitivity than something against Christians. Just this kind of woke worldview. And so that's where humans are, when the AI, they train the AIs to be a little bit lefty. Google then went a step further and just added their own words to the user query secretly. And that came from, you know, the HR DEI department at Google.
Yeah.
So that's how you get that kind of extra bias beyond just the baked in leftism that comes from how they do the reinforcement learning.
So I'm trying to figure out the next step. Are there any conservatives or right wingers who might think of getting into this and doing this, or is all technology controlled by the far left? Do right wingers stay at home and kind of just do their little business work and say, I'm going to stay in my own little world and I'm not going to get into this, because it seems like you lose in politics, you're outnumbered in this stuff, you know, just education, academia. Come on, start doing this, conservatives, right?
Yeah, well, so there is good news on that front. Elon Musk he bought Twitter, and under that banner, he's launched an AI called Grok. And it's actually still a little bit leftist, but Musk has publicly said, you know, he's aware of that, and he wants to make it a centrist, reasonable AI. So this is good news. There are also companies like, in search, Google has 90% of the search market, and that's not healthy. The good news is the AI market is very high competition right now, from everyone from Google to Microsoft to startups like OpenAI and Anthropic. And a lot of these companies, I know people at some of these who are lean libertarian, and a lot of these people just want to make the smartest AI possible. So if the companies can get their DEI department to stop meddling, I think we'll be okay.
So don't trust it, because I also said, you know, write me a story about Larry Marino. And it started out okay. I could see, you know, listed how long I've been doing what I do. And then it said I write articles for Metallurgy Magazine in addition. And it's like, okay, I bet there's another Larry Marino out there. So it's right. It has trouble, doesn't it, figuring out what is correct?
Absolutely. You know, I actually, just in the last few days, I gave these AIs IQ tests manually. And when I describe it, it can't see the IQ test well enough yet, but when I describe it to them in words, they can do sort of okay. Well, the best AI, ChatGPT, scored an 85 IQ. That's way below average for a human, but it's something. I think it makes a lot of sense, because yeah, it can kind of write you an essay. It also has all the knowledge in the world. So it's kind of, has a leg up on the knowledge front. And then it's not that smart, but it cobbles together something that sort of works, but also just get things totally wrong. Whereas if you had a good executive assistant, you know, they would probably be like, oh, that's a different Larry. I'm not going to include Metallurgy Magazine.
Right. Not bad, but Metallurgy Magazine. I mean, I'm thinking that here's another totally different thing. And it's slightly off from what you're talking about, but I saw my first AI autonomous vehicle on the street next to me the other day.
Mm-hmm.
First time, looked over to actually see no one at the steering wheel, and there it is going by. And I said, well, there it is. And I Googled, and sure enough, they've been authorized to test. There's a company that's picking up people. And I'll just share the story. It just is a sign of the times. Somebody tried to allegedly steal one of those. You know, they kind of got in the driver's side and started to try to see if they could do it. And a voice came on and said, you know, get out. And that individual wouldn't. And he was caught and arrested for, you know, attempted auto theft, grand auto. But then I had to Google, you know, how many Americans would ride in one of those things? How many wouldn't? And would you? And so I thought to myself, well, based on my AI experience and how it gets things wrong, you know, when I'm on the internet, what do I think here? And I said, I wouldn't ride in one yet. How about you? Have you done that, or would you?
Yeah, you know, I have. I went out to San Francisco to do a report on these, and I rode in them. And I was impressed. You know, so if you were to just take one of these cars and say, hey, drive me from San Francisco to San Jose, yeah, that would be dangerous, and I wouldn't do that, because it would involve kind of uncharted territory that this robot car would be. If it makes a mistake, you're dead. But what these companies have done, is Waymo is the leader, and they've mapped out everything in San Francisco, and they've kind of tried to cover every corner case, and they've done it pretty well. So they've been They've driven millions of miles in San Francisco and no fatalities caused by the car. They cause fewer accidents than human drivers already. But again, it's because they've mapped out this kind of safe area for the AI. But if you take that kind of human curation off, it doesn't work yet. Maybe in 10 years.
Yeah.
But in San Francisco, it's working. And also Phoenix. They're doing it in these dry, warm places because snow causes trouble for AIs. And in Phoenix, you can go there, download the Waymo app, and get in one of these driverless cars and, try it yourself. And it is like living in the future. It's pretty cool.
You look over from the back seat and you see the steering wheel turning. Somebody described it as like having an invisible driver.
Yeah, it's like a ghost is at the wheel. It's pretty amazing.
But you're not, because it's in such a contained area, you're not afraid of it. But you say if you took it on a big, long drive. Well, I mean, they're looking to do the same things on long-haul truck routes, these big, huge trucks. You know, from Austin, Texas to some other city, and they're on the highway, and it's like, okay. I mean, and then you start, I start typing into the AI, who do you sue if you get into a wreck? Would it stop? And what if it didn't, if it hits you? How would you prove your case? Well, these things have cameras on all corners, right? So they probably have more documentation about an accident than you do, right?
So that's a good question, and the states are still trying to figure out rules and stuff. As far as the long distance trucking, I saw Texas is already building a driverless car only trucking corridor. So there are solutions like that might help things along. In general, I think this stuff is starting to hit pretty rapidly and improve pretty rapidly. So I think we're going to be in kind of a brave new world. I'm not sure we're ready for, but that's my prediction.
All right, Max, I'm out of time. Mention the website if folks want to go and see. And you've compared where they, in kind of a little chart there, where the different AIs rank as far as their bias. What's the website?
It's trackingai.org. And I also have, I'm doing write-ups about this on MaximumTruth.org. So my name's Maxim Lott, MaximumTruth.org. It's a play on that.
Excellent.
Well, thank you very much. It was a great discussion.
Thank you.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Jesse Hezon is the Director of Operations for the Embassy Suites in Glendale, and he is joining us to give us kind of boots on the ground, man on the ground feeling for the economy and how things are chugging along over there. Jesse, thank you so much for being with us on our program today.
Thank you for giving me the time.
Yes. Let's talk about, first off, the hotel industry as a whole. A couple of years after the COVID lockdowns and everything got shut down, has it come back? Has the travel market returned to pre-COVID levels, or is there still some work on that to happen?
Business travelers are still not picking up as the way it used to be. Leisure is what we are depending on at this time. You know, normally they come Thursdays all the way for the weekend. But the business travelers were still a little bit challenging for us.
Yeah. And of course, where you are in Glendale, you're an amazing location for folks to just go down the freeway and be at Universal Studios and, you know, enjoy all that's in that part of town, aren't you? I mean, it's a great destination location to travel to Glendale, stay there, and just a quick jaunt over and you're at Universal Studios.
Yes, actually, the advantage that we have, you know, Embassy Suites, as everybody probably knows, you know, it's a two-room suite. Families are more attracted to it, you know, and having a complimentary breakfast and a manager's reception at nighttime, that really helps a lot of our families.
Right. Well, give us a sense. You know, we're told inflation has gone way up, maybe easing back a little bit. Has the hotel industry been immune from that, or have you had to reflect the increased cost of supplies and things that you use? How has it impacted what you do in your location, inflation?
It impacted us a lot, especially, you know, our cost things. We have to make adjustments on how we calculate our cost or our bottom line. Of course, we cannot compete with other restaurants because, you know, we still have to keep our level down just because, you know, they're spending a lot of money staying in the rooms. And, of course, in food and beverage, the same thing. We just have to kind of balance both so our the families can still afford to come to us.
Yeah. And I know the word margin is always used in business when you look at by the time you've paid everybody versus what you have left over. Is the hotel industry a field when you have restaurants and when you have this that the margins are tight, or is there some space there? Is it an industry that you have to watch extremely closely?
We extremely, really, really, keep an eye on it on a day-to-day basis. You know, as we look at into our costings, you know, our revenue from the room side and then on the food side, you know, and then especially, you know, the labor is the most expensive cost to any companies, any, business. So that's where we really watch our labor and make sure that, of course, our staff still have to work. So we have to make some adjustments and make sure that we accommodate their needs at the same time as our needs.
Yeah. I want to ask you about technology. Technology with apps seems to kind of be getting into all sorts of industries. You see these ads on TV for websites that compare rooms and costs and, you know, really try to give the consumer an edge. Are those tools valuable? Do you endorse them? Are they a challenge for you? Do they work? I mean, can people buy a room and not actually buy it directly through you? I'm curious because, you know, you see all these ads on TV for sites that can find you the lowest price, that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we always have to work with all these websites, you know, and definitely there's an advantage for hotel people, for guests that likes to get savings. Yes, they use the third party. In a sense, also, it's pretty much probably 60-40, 50-50. You know, a lot of people are still trying to get into those websites. And, of course, the Hilton always tells them, hey, you have more advantages on using the Hilton or our own website just because, you know, being a member, Hilton Honor member, you have a lot of benefits.
What are consumers telling you as we are in this post-COVID time? It sounds like, just from personal experience, you know, we all had cabin fever. We want to get out. Is there a kind of a drive for tourists who kind of stayed home for several years that they really enjoy getting out, coming to Glendale, staying with you, and then being able to go and do the touristy things in Southern California? There's a longing for that, isn't there?
Absolutely, yes, they are. A lot of families now are, you know, this is where we actually take advantage of. It's just because with the COVID and everything, now they're out here, but they want to enjoy it. And yes, absolutely. Families are really taking advantage of this.
Is there any market for staycations for people who live already in Southern California, but just kind of want to change the scenery and, you know, maybe get closer to Universal Studios and stay at your place and kind of do a vacation? Do you ever get any local people who rent?
Oh, yes. In Glendale, we see at least about 20% of them are locals. Glendale. And it is interesting to see that. It's because, you know, they like to get into a hotel and just really enjoy the luxury, right? That's how people are thinking nowadays, is like stay out of their places and go to a hotel and just enjoy all the luxury and the benefits of it.
Yeah. With hotels comes the luxuries with it. There's, of course, the meals, the restaurants, the food, the experience. It all can be, you know, brought into it as a full experience. Do you find that a lot of people are members, because you kind of mentioned it earlier, of associations, Hilton Honors Club and things like that, and Embassy Suites has their own, or a lot of people kind of outside that and just kind of buy their reservation directly. Is there an advantage to having a membership?
it is an advantage to have a membership, you know, especially some people are just first travelers. You know, they use a third party. And then when they get into the property and says, oh, can I get this free Wi-Fi, you know, complimentary all. And once they get to realize, oh, yeah, there's an advantage of being a member, you know, all over the United States. And you know, they take advantage and say, okay, I'll be a Hilton member. I'll be a member of it. So at least you get points. You get all these benefits, 50% off on food and beverage and all that stuff.
Right. You get some conversions of people who've come in on, you know, the third party and say, hey, wait a second. What I really want is to be able to get the freebies, the Wi-Fi, some of the other things that go with the experience, because really, that's, you know, it's the package. And as you say, you specialize in folks coming in with families, right? Because of the way Embassy Suites are set up, it's very convenient for them to have rooms that are set up the way they are, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Trends from the business side, you said it's a little, I don't want to say the word sluggish, but why do you think the business side is a little slow to come back in? Is it just, you know, tightened dollars? Is it good old Zoom that a lot of businesses discovered you could have meetings over Zoom and maybe it's not as good, but it saves on the travel costs? Is it possible that some of it won't ever return?
It's, you know, during COVID, you know, a lot of people, a lot of business had the stay home, right? So now they kind of realize how the balance of expenses being in an office and being at home, convenience for families that has kids, you know, babysitters and all that. So now they kind of realize, wait, you know, I think it's a good thing, you know, staying home, you know, working at home. So that's kind of disadvantage that we have right now, that in our buildings in front of us, you know, it's probably 30% empty. Because everybody just left the offices and companies are now work at home.
Right. And does that impact those who might come over for lunch or have a business meeting or utilize you for other services, right?
Yes. And that affected us on getting into that before, way back in before COVID. You know, everybody comes to the restaurant. We have a competition, you know, in our market, we have two more restaurants in front of us, but at least we get the share from it. Right. Now, really, it's a handful of people just being in the office.
Right, right. I was going to ask you about another aspect of your industry, and that is the room rental where you get like a conference room and hold an event. Many hotels, and in yours I've been there, you know, have kind of like, I want to call them conference areas, but, you know, big rooms that are expandable. Is that market easing back and coming back a little bit?
It is coming back this year. Last year, it was a struggle. You know, they still don't do their meetings, you know, room rentals. But now we see the trend. It's all coming back now. They all wanted to have a big meetings. It used to be big meetings way back and then small meetings. Now I can see for the trend for 2024, yes, I agree. Now everybody's like getting back to it. You know, the companies that we had way back 3-4 years ago, now I see them back again, which is, we're glad to see them again.
And in fact, if you have a business and it's going to have a get-together party event conference, going to be some competition for the rooms, because as you fill back up, you know, it's not going to be as easy to pencil them in. They need to call you in advance, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Well, Jesse, it sounds like, you know, things are kind of coming back. You'd like to see more of it. You'd like to see more in the business way. You're appreciative of the tourism side and that families see Glendale as a good location to be adjacent to Universal Studios, just a couple of miles away. And you're seeing some positives out there, right?
Absolutely, yes, I agree. It is very positive now. You know, we're looking at the numbers and we're comparing it now to 2018, which is the most successful year for hotel industry for us. So now we are really hoping that it comes back as the way it used to be in 2018.
Jesse Heason, you are Director of Operations over there at the Embassy Suites in Glendale. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.